You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Thank you very much. I don't really need an introduction because that's the reason you're here is for Richard Rohr. And I'm hoping that Richard is in... Yes.
Well, they're all even live. God bless them.
So if anyone's in any doubt, this is Richard Rohr. Now, I don't know, Richard can see some of you, but not all of you. Nothing personal, it's to do with cameras. Please raise your hands if you've read one of Richard's books. Okay, let's do that another way. Please, no, I won't do that. Please, that, Richard, that was 97.3% have read your books. Please raise your hands if you receive an email from Richard most days. That's 97.8%. So you're very well known, Richard, and we're really, really delighted to have you joining us from New Mexico today. First of all, we'd like to ask, what is the weather? What is the temperature like in New Mexico today?
It's full sun and, what would you say, guys?
75 right now.
Right now.
85?
It'll get up to 85.
85. Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Full sun, 85. Very similar to here. So.
I noticed your coats, yeah.
So, a brief introduction for the 2% of you who aren't entirely familiar with Richard. Richard actually did speak at Greenbelt about 20 years ago. 21 years ago, thank you. And he has become increasingly influential through the publication of important books year after year after year, through the influence of his daily email from the Center for Action and Contemplation in Albuquerque, and from people who visit that center to get some clues as to how to live an integrated spiritual life. And in particular today, in the first part of our conversation, we're going to talk to Richard about his forthcoming book, which is called The Tears of Things. And this is a book which is about the figures in what Christians call the Old Testament, who are known as the prophets. So, Richard, first of all, these prophets, they've got names like Jeremiah and Hosea. We've heard these names from the Bible. When we talk about the prophets, who are the people we're talking about?
Well, you know, at the end of the book, I have three columns. There's those who speak and don't write, who are the first ones we're familiar with, Elijah, for example. Then there's those who write, and that's the ones we're most familiar with because we can quote them. And then there's what I call the prophetic narratives, Jonah, Lamentations, and I might surprise some people, but I put Job in that list. Job isn't in the classic list of prophets, but I think the narrative of his story fits perfectly what I'm trying to say about the prophets.
Now, some people, Richard, may have an impression of the prophets, at least some of them, as bad-tempered, fed up, whiny, judgy, maybe a little into amateur dramatics, performative, attention-seeking. Is this a misunderstanding?
Unfortunately, it is not in their beginnings. It's just like meeting a young man or a young woman. They're still in their early stages of formation. And that's where almost all the prophets start. Rageful. Now the irony is, the rage is a deserved rage, but it doesn't work to change people. It just makes them enraged too. Doesn't necessarily make them act or change or grow up. And that's one of my major points in the book, that the prophets themselves move from anger to tears, lamentation, to actually doxology, praise, and to chart their course is to really chart the growth of our own human maturity, maturing.
Okay,
does
thank
that
you.
Make sense?
Yes. So you write in the book that these Hebrew prophets, as you just indicated, they take a journey, and the great ones, you name Ezekiel, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos. On this journey, they become transformed, but some of them, and you name Obadiah and Nahum, remain angry, complaining old men until the end. And yet you write, we kept their books in the Bible, and you call them incomplete prophets, not false prophets. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
I have to add John the Baptist. I know that'll surprise and shock most people, but I believe John the Baptist is an incomplete prophet because he remains at his anger stage, and he concentrates on the sexual sin of an individual. That's completely contrary to what Amos and the major prophets do, who always emphasize the sin of the culture. Woe to you, Bethsaida, as Jesus would put them. Woe to you, Chorazin. Woe to you, Jerusalem. They convict the collective. That's a huge transfer of attention. It's one we still need, because we're still, I'll pick on U.S. since that's all I can pick on. There's not much point to hating the latest gunfighter in Texas and convicting him without making people aware that the entire U.S. and state of Texas loves their gun culture. Sin is, first of all, collective and agreed upon as not sin. That's why we get away sinning. The culture says it's good. So I have a place somewhere in the middle of the book where I say, for the individual, killing is wrong. For the collective, war is bad. Although we never really imposed that one either.
So one of the themes is you're saying that the prophets are dealing with the collective, not the individual.
Overwhelming. If you don't believe me, it's amazing to me that this has not been more pointed out. Just read Amos. I think I counted 36 Moab, the naming of cities, naming of villages, naming of areas. You, the way you think up there in, where can I pick on it, England? Nottingham. I loved it there. That's a different way than we talk. We let the culture off scot-free. I mean, that's how empire took control in your country and how it's taken control in our country. Because it's never addressed. We just think we got to find the few bad eggs, apples, whichever one you say, I don't know.
Rather
find
than
the bad apple and get rid of the bad apple, put him in jail, while the gun culture of America charges ahead full steam, uncritiqued.
So, Richard, why did some of these prophets make a successful journey and others not? How come John the Baptist didn't get it?
So you don't think I'm a complete heretic and trying to follow Jesus? I got the courage to say that from Jesus' line, no man born of woman is greater than John the Baptist. He represents very well what I call the first half of life, moralistic, but it's still black and white. But then Jesus follows that with the least born into the kingdom of God is greater than John the Baptist. He critiques his own cousin. because John the Baptist is not a mature prophet. He's caught up in his head judgments, as most judgmental people are, as I have been much of my life. The book is also, in effect, autobiographical. I'm a one on the Enneagram, for those of you who know the Enneagram. And it's a terrible burden to carry your own judgmentalism. It tires you out. I'm 81 now, and I just get sick of being critical. But the prophet showed me a positive way to be critical. We'll try to explain that later.
Okay, so I just want to go back to Ezekiel, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Amos. They made this journey and they were transformed. So what's the journey and what's the transformation?
At one point in the book, I encourage readers to get three highlighters and start reading any one of the prophets, except Obadiah, Nahum, and John the Baptist. And you'll note that they all start wrathful, angry, judgmental, accusatory, dualistic in their thinking. And that's why, frankly, a lot of people shut the book. It sounds like their rageaholic father, if you had one. I hope you didn't. And I tell them to mark those lines with the red highlighter. Do you call them highlighters over there?
Yeah,
okay. Then I say, stay with the text, and you'll see that there's a transformative period, either holy, 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 like Isaiah 6, discovering the real absolute, the beginnings of some appropriate self-doubt, some humility, some kind of God encounter. I say mark those with yellow. Stay with the text. And I don't need to prove this to you. It's there in every one. And mark these with green. These are the real inspired passages in the prophets, where they get to their, well, let's pick Habakkuk, someone none of you are named after. And after screaming at us for three chapters, Habakkuk in the last three verses says, but I will carry you like hinds feet on high places. Excuse me. And I will praise Yahweh. He moves from anger and rage to doxology. I'm not sure if it's Walter Brueggemann or Abraham Heschel. One of them calls this the great nevertheless. You'll find in every prophet, there's the great nevertheless, where they list the sins of Israel, entirely self-critical before they're critical of any other nation state. And then they say, nevertheless, I'm going to love you, Israel, even more. I'm going to drown you in love until you experience that you are the betrothed, the beloved of the covenant. So these same people who are so rageful, O.C. would be an outstanding example. I think you pronounced it a little different. How do you say O.C. over there? Hosea?
Hosea, yeah.
Yeah, Hosea. I mean, his language is almost, it isn't almost, it's erotic. The whole beloved relationship between God and humanity. It's good stuff. There you mark that with green. Now, if you check, for those of you who are preachers, everyone who quotes the prophets, those are the only lines you quote anyway, unless you're having a bad day, which a lot of us are a lot of times. But there are quotes that are worthy of quoting. So some of you know my paradigm of order, disorder, reorder. They start with what they think is order, keeping retributive justice of reward and punishment at work. Then some wrench is thrown into the works where it becomes unbelievable, even to them. It doesn't fit the facts. That's the second stage of wisdom. And only when you hold on to order, but don't deny disorder, exceptions to the rule, and you get to reorder. That's the wisdom literature. All restorative justice instead of retributive justice. Each in their own way, some more than others. Jeremiah gets there, Ezekiel gets there magnificently. I think it's Ezekiel who uses the word, I will restore you 7 or 8 times in a row. I will restore you, I will restore you. He stopped punishing. Brothers and sisters, as long as we have God being wrathful, we don't have much hope of changing Western civilization. We just create wrathful people who replicate the Creator, and nobody likes us. We have to find the mercy of God, and that's that beautiful Hebrew word hesed that many of them used to describe the third stage of reorder. Hesed, God is known for steadfast love, infinite love, eternal love. It takes all of us a while to get there, to even dare to believe it. And it takes the prophets a while to get there, which is sort of good news. We don't feel like we're such horrible students.
You've got a couple of parallel processes. You've got the move from order to disorder to reorder. And then you've got the move from anger to tears or lamentation, and then to praise or doxology.
Yes. Or compassion. They're all, it's all pouring out of them. Compassion, praise, love, steadfast love.
Your book itself is called The Tears of Things. Where's that phrase from, and why that title?
I think your people are prepared to put the cover on the screen. Can they do that now? Prophetic wisdom for an age of outrage. The phrase is from, for those of you who had to study Latin like I did, it's from the Aeneid, written by Virgil. And in the first book, Virgil, observing a mural in Carthage of all the murdered soldiers on both the Roman side and the Carthaginian side, uses this little phrase, the tears of things. In Latin, it doesn't have a preposition. It's simply two words, tear, lacrimae, tears, things, rerum, the tears of things. And it can be understood on two levels. Everything has tears, is broken. It's really a statement about the tragic sense of life. We call it the folly of the cross. But the tears pour things. And when you get to the point, it usually doesn't happen before the second half of life, to use my language, where you stop hating things and you realize that everything is wounded, everything is broken, everything is crucified. Why hate it? Why make it suffer more? So it became for me the perfect title for the book, and the publishers liked it very much. So it looks like it's going to stand. Now, they gave it the subtitle, Prophetic Wisdom from an Age of Outrage. I don't know if England is as bad as we are, but most Americans, I hope, are getting tired of being angry. It's just, does everybody have to be opinionated and upset? So I think the prophetic journey from rage to tears to compassion is prophetic wisdom for an age of outrage. Because the initial anger is not wrong. There's much in our world that deserves anger, that deserves outrage. But you can't stay there, or it has you instead of you having it. I know you know that already, but a lot of people don't, especially young bucks, young activists, young people who are driven and motivated by their rage. Rage gives you power. It's not refined power, though. It's too tied to the ego. It's too tied to your own woundedness. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So I'm going to come back to what you said about the sense of sadness, particularly in the later part of life, in a minute. But you use this very intriguing phrase. You talk about spiritual bypassing. And I wanted to ask you, what is spiritual bypassing?
We use it here at the center quite a lot in our living school and with our interns. It's the temptation to push the shortcut button too quickly with a Bible quote or a highly spiritual answer, to talk too quickly about the story before you recognize the influence of my story and our story, before you recognize the influence of psychology, anthropology. You've got to walk through a lot of different schemas of understanding yourself. Why does that quote appeal to you? Why does that quote anger you? Why does that quote whatever? It's just good historical critical criticism of the Bible or of the church. So you have to start with what John Lewis, the black congressman, called in Washington, good trouble. You have to start with good trouble. Make some good trouble. But don't stay there. All it does is inflate your own ego and give you permission to be nasty to other people. I don't know if you use the word nasty like we do, but...
Yeah, we get it. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
But are you also saying that, I mean, we're all familiar, many of the people here today are activists working for peace and justice in the world. Many of us were once young. Many of us are still young. It's not possible to jump quickly from the stage of anger to the stage of tears, is it? You can't do that spiritual bypassing.
No. It's only usually through suffering. I'll tell you why that line took on so much importance for me. In the early 90s, I spent 5 years reading everything I could on the rather universal phenomenon of male initiation rites. We've given a few of them in your country, in fact. I think the English team. Oh, did you make it?
You were at Green Book talking about that, yeah.
In fact, I was at the first one in Leicestershire. Am I saying it right? Leicestershire.
I think you say Leicestershire.
Yeah, we say
Leicestershire. Anyway, carry on.
And please don't take offense at this. I couldn't understand their English. I didn't know what they were saying. I had to have a translator. It was beautiful to hear, but it made no sense to the ear. Do they still talk different in Leicestershire?
Yeah.
It's amazing. Your island is so small, and you speak with 55 different accents, and our country is so big, and our English is generally uniform. I don't know what the reason for that is.
Yeah. Probably maybe that's
explains our love for uniformity.
Yeah, no.
What did you ask me? I forgot the point.
It's fine. I think we were getting
into... I know.
Oh, yeah.
I know what it was. When I still led, before I retired, and I would lead those rites of passage, there's the third day is called the Day of Grief. Now it's become an entire science called grief work. There's whole conferences helping people to process their grief. And I would say to the boys, the men, a lot of you think you're angry. And a lot of you are. A lot of you think your dad was very angry. And he probably was. But let me tell you something, and please believe me. And once the words would come out of my mouth, the room would be stunned to silence. I'd say, believe me, most of you are not angry, you are sad. And they would just pull back. And we could send them into an hour of talking with one another. Because it never occurred to them that they were much more sad than angry. That's what gave me the insight to write the book, The Tears of Things. Sadness is a liminal space that if you process and don't shortcut around it, if you do your grief work and recognize you just want to cry. I mean, how can you look at Gaza? How can you look at Ukraine and Sudan and not just weep? There's no point, well, there's a little point in getting angry at the powers that be. But that's got to move beyond anger to something that's transformative. Anger just feeds the ego. Tears feed the soul. But your wives and your daughters, women have much more permission to cry, much more freedom to cry, and to learn from it. They have much more freedom to touch one another when they are crying. We're afraid to do it. We're afraid we'll be called gay. It's just also sick. I'm critiquing culture the way I think the prophets did. The trip that has been put on men, we good Anglo-Saxon men. I'm German, so I'm one of you.
When you that thing
go ahead.
About signs of sadness. So you mentioned that as we become older, sadness may become more present in our lives. But then you use this phrase, which I think you've taken from the Orthodox Church, the way that they describe the season of Lent as a season of bright sadness. And you talk about the fact that when we get older and experience sadness, it needn't be depression, It can be an enlightened sadness.
There you go. Yes. See, we only have clinical therapeutic language. More in our country, I think, even than yours. That's spiritual bypassing, where you jump to therapeutic language, which is very helpful, by the way. Don't hear me in a dualistic way that it's good or bad. But you use therapeutic language to learn this, to avoid the spiritual lessons. And, you know, Jesus didn't say, blessed are those who weep for no reason. How happy are those who weep? He wept himself at least twice over Jerusalem, the collective, notice, and over Lazarus, also the individual. I made the point in the book, I don't know that I can prove it, but when it says in the Garden of Gethsemane that he wept blood. No, the word isn't wept. What do they say? You know.
Shed.
He shed tears of blood. Is that what? I'm sorry. My mind is getting so weak anymore. But I think they're really talking about Jesus weeping. And the tears of Jesus in Gethsemane were so real, so painful, they were like the dripping of blood. That's my interpretation.
Thank you, Richard. So we'll just wrap up our conversation about the new book with a final question, and then we'll ask you some broader questions which people from the Greenbelt community have emailed in the last few days. So you say that some of the prophets, towards the end of their recorded works, turn to praise and thanks. They sense that they can be free even when they are practically unfree. How does that work?
That's still a mystery to me, how that works. So I'm glad you asked the question. How can you be still trapped in unfreedom? I think it's, first of all, a recognition that your unfreedom is unfreedom. I'm driven, I'm obsessive, I'm preoccupied, I'm depressed, that my sadness is not, we used to say in my charismatic days, maybe some of you had those, tears that were from God and tears that were just from the human situation. There's a different character to tears from God. They're not about you. They're really not. They're about the tragic sense of life, the futile sense of life, that everything, everybody is suffering. And you stop applying guilt or attributing guilt to people, and you just weep over the absurdity of it all. How can you see on the evening news Gaza and not recognize you are looking at total evil absurdity? And yet here's where I want to throw in, at least in our country, the group that most disapproves of what Israel is doing in the Holy Land, 37% of American Jews do not agree with the Israeli government. And I would like to make the case that I think the Jewish people got that capacity for creative self-criticism from the prophets.
Okay. Thank you, Richard. I'm just going to take a straw poll. The book comes out later this year. How many people are going to buy this book? Oh, that's very good. That's, I got 72% then, so that's very high. So thank you, Richard. So we thank you for talking to us about the tiers of things. We're going to move to some of the wider questions that people have sent in, because we don't want to keep you for too long. Many people here will be familiar with the Enneagram, because you were one of the people who popularized it around the world from the 1980s. Yeah. Judy from Southwold is a big fan, and she asks, what you say to people who are skeptical about the Enneagram, people who might learn about themselves if they were to explore it?
I can understand. It doesn't sound biblical. It doesn't sound Christian, even though the oldest form of it is from one of the desert fathers, a strangely named man called Evagrius Ponticus. And he said there were 8 barriers to prayer. And he lists what he calls 8 passions that keep you from the freedom of prayer. He misses fear, which is the biggest one of all. It's so universal and never called sin, they don't recognize it as sin. Just that should help us realize we're on to some deep wisdom here. Now, it kept recurring in different forms. A Franciscan of my own community recovered it in the 13th century, and he again called it the 8 passions. They still missed fear. It's amazing how we so made fear, because we had that line, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. We made fear a good thing, even though the Bible says, I'm told, sounds too clever. Do not be afraid 365 times. I don't think you need to be afraid of the Enneagram. The only thing that needs to be afraid of the Enneagram is your ego. Okay. Because it exposes the ego. And I say that after learning it in 1972 and using it in spiritual direction ever since. It's allowed me to save marriages, to save people's psyches, their self-understanding. I don't teach it much anymore, but don't be afraid. It's a gift.
Thank you, Richard. Helen asks, what's the difference between Buddhist meditation and Christian contemplative practice?
Oh, I wish we had an hour. But let me sum it up best. Like, we who are Christian still believe that reality has a face, has a beloved face, is a personal relatedness. We use probably too glibly, too easily, too quickly, we use the word God. And I'm not ready to give that word up. I think reality does have a benevolent face. And that word is God, just as good as anything else. But our Buddhist brothers and sisters have refined the techniques in many cases, perhaps better than we have. But they're afraid to address a person or to be addressed by a person, by a moment, by an event, by a relationship. You good evangelicals speak of having a personal relationship with Jesus. That's good. So I think the personalism, the relationality of Christian meditation deeply distinguishes it from much of Buddhism.
And would you say that people in those different traditions are heading to the same place through their practice?
They're both talking about unitive consciousness, overcoming dualistic thinking of either or, and learning to think both and. I and the Father are one. Once you learn to think with the mind of Christ, the mind of God, it's not you who's doing the thinking. You know what changes? Righteousness. You don't need to be right anymore because they're not your thoughts. All you are is, as Mother Teresa said, is a pencil in God's hands. And at my age, that becomes very believable, very real, that you know you haven't done all this. It's being done in you and to you and through you. That's why we Catholics loved Mary so much. She was so aware. She was carrying the Christ. She was an instrument. And that's good stuff. That's the heart of the matter. We are not the Christ, but we are the body of Christ, and we are carrying the Christ.
Thank you. A different Richard writes to say that he's read many of your books, and while he used to be devout, he's now lost his faith. He doesn't imply there's a connection. He says he cannot unsee all the oppression that religion gives rise to. He asks if your stance, which you've just hinted at, on non-dual thinking is wide enough to accept people like him, by which I think he means people who would no longer claim to have a particular faith.
That's the least of my problems. What are God's problems? What name you use to call yourself is really rather meaningless. The ego freedom I hear in his question. Afraid, what if I'm wrong, but yet I have to be true to myself? I'll take that kind of humility any day than the righteousness of an overly certain Christian. You've heard me say, Martin, the opposite of faith is not doubt. And I'll say it twice. The opposite of faith is certitude. The opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is certitude. And let me pick on your country just a little teeny bit. I wish I could get back there once more, but I'm too weak now. I remember preaching once in Norwich Cathedral, up in the beautiful raised pulpit, and I went back to the vestibule afterwards to sign books, and a wonderful, proper, well-educated Englishman from East Anglia, where we even got our accent, we're told. He said, I was teaching them on detachment from our own opinions, detachment from our own mind. And he said, how dare you come over here and insult the brilliant English mind? He said, we worked hard to think well. And I said, you did, you really did. In fact, even the Pope says when we lost England to the Roman Church, we lost one of its greatest gifts because we recognized the strength, but he wouldn't let me continue. All he wanted to do was defend the English mind. It's that mind that cannot grow. I'm sure he's changed by now, but yeah, that was 15 years ago.
I'm sure he's here today. Yeah.
I hope so.
So on that theme again, Ruth asks, could you say a little more about non-dual thinking?
The word itself was never common in the West. It was held more by the Eastern religions. when you recognize something is not entirely one and the same, but it's not different and two either. When you can say it's not one and it's not two, you're living with paradox. Am I seeing balloons? Or is that my mind?
I think that's your mind.
Oh, I just saw a bunch of balloons.
I mean, the thing is, we do recognize you have special spiritual insight. So you, you could be seeing something that's true. And
I keep seeing balloons across the screen.
Yeah.
Must be left over from Kamala's talk the other night. Anyway, what were we saying? Bring me back to my point. I'm terrible.
We were talking about non-dual thinking and balloons.
Yeah. Non-dual thinking is an ability to live with mystery, to not be so certain. Mystery is not something you cannot know. It's something that you can endlessly know. Its knowability never stops. That's a very different notion of knowing something. Once we don't recognize that God is infinitely knowable, and any name is inadequate. You know, the two great theophanies, Sinai and Tabor, if you notice in both Old Testament so-called Hebrew scripture and Christian scripture, after the theophany, after the manifestation, the sky is overrun with clouds. It was probably one of your English writers, Cynthia Bourgeau, one of our teachers here, intuited it was from Tintern Abbey that the book The Cloud of Unknowing was written. There's that good English mind, that good English mind that said the cloud of covering of theophany, saying you think you know now, you only half know at best. That's a good way to know.
Thank you.
If religion had approached Western civilization with more humility like that, I know, but I know I don't know. And apply that to everything I've said today. Those are people you can talk to. Those are people you can grow with, you can relate to. We all need a lot to learn, but we were identified with empire. You with the British, we with the American. Once you're identified with empire, you don't know much about mystery. You have too many certitudes. Does that ring true?
Yeah, that rings true. Thank you. I like the notion of a holy agnosticism.
That's a good phrase. Holy not knowing.
Celia says, although I believe we are all held forever in eternal love, I'm very afraid of death. And she'd like to ask you how you intuit what after death is like.
Well, you know, out of my own psyche, I recognize how God has loved me unconditionally. Inside of my brokenness and sinfulness and phoniness again and again and again and again. Now tell me, why would God change God's mind after I die? Why does he love, she love unconditionally in this world? And we preachers are supposed to preach that. I hope you do. But then all the rules change once you die. Now God loves with complete conditionality. It can't be true. It can, you know, a word that many of the prophets resort to at the reorder level is infinite or eternal. I often, in my later years of preaching, would ask a crowd, cut infinity in half. What's half of infinity? Come on. And they'd hesitate. They wouldn't want to appear stupid, at least Americans. And I'd say, come on, say it. It's infinity. What's a fourth of infinity? It's infinity. What's a hundredth of infinity? It's infinity. We don't know how to relate to the infinite. So we portion it out. We measure it. We make stories about guys who came at the first hour who deserve as much or more than those who came at the last hour. What was Jesus warning us against? Once you've experienced the infinite love of God, you stop measuring, you stop weighing, you stop counting, you stop deserving. All language of math, my favorite French mystic, Thérèse of Lisieux, she said, God knows all the sciences, but there's one science that God does not know. God does not understand mathematics. Brilliant, brilliant. God does not understand mathematics. God is not a counter. But we are counters.
And your own, in recent years, you've been quite ill quite often. You've talked about being healed. Has your own experience of living with mortality informed your view of death and what's next?
Well, you're right. I've had 5 unrelated cancers. And the doctor wants to do a genetic study on me. How can you have 5 cancers and be healed of every one of them? I don't know how to explain it myself. Each one has weakened my body more. You can hear it in my voice. So it's weakened my body more. But I do think there's been a strengthening of, okay, Richard, you're at the end of your life. You might as well go for broke. Do you use that expression, go for broke?
Yep.
What you really believe, what you really have experienced. And I've experienced a God who has loved me through every stage of my life, and most especially when I am weak and sinful and poor. So yeah, answer to your question, yes.
So this relates to a question that Nick raises. He says, on the long journey of faith that you've been on, what in your current belief system do you think might still be way off the mark?
That's a good question. What do I fear might be way off the mark? It's not the love of God. That's the absolute. That's the one stable, eternal message. I probably have been too critical of the church. And yet I learned that from the prophets, but I'm not going to let myself off the hook. The church taught me all that I know via the Franciscans to get the Franciscan version of it. Two of the Franciscans I quote in the book are both from the UK. John Duns-Scotus from right north of Hadrian's Wall, one of my favorites, and one you might not yourself know of. I hope you do. William of Ockham. And we studied him in philosophy class. I think you say Ockham. Isn't there a city named Ockham?
Well, we'll take either.
You always give us choices. I visited his tomb. He's in the Franciscan house in Munich. And he gave us what we call, you learn it if you study philosophy, Occam's razor. Maybe you've heard that phrase.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, you've got to cut away all the unneeded assumptions. And the answer with the fewest assumptions, there's that good English mind again. He said, the answer with the fewest assumption, the most simple answer is most likely the truth. That's guided many a Franciscan. And for me, the most simple answer is it's all about love. It starts with love. Its energy is love, and it leads us to love. When it leads us to law, it's not, it needs some shaving from Occam's razor.
Thank you, Richard. One final question. Someone writes that in the face of the climate emergency, the destruction of Gaza, an increase in racism, Islamophobia, anti-migrant rhetoric, how do we cultivate hope?
Well, I know how you can't cultivate, and that's by looking at the data. We call faith, hope, and charity the theological virtues. I'm sure the Episcopal Church did too. And the theological virtues were not gained by effort, were not attained by performance. They were a participation in the very life of God. It was God rubbing off on you. God taking over a bit of your mind, a bit of your heart, a bit of your soul, and you find yourself feeling, thinking like God. And you don't know how you got there. Like when I have hopeful days, I awoke with hope today. I don't know why. I don't know how. Did I have good dreams last night? Did I have good news? Well, at least Kamala is nominated. There's some good news. But my hope doesn't come from that. It really is a participation in the very life of God. I believe that's true. That's why we can never stop talking about faith, hope, and charity. These are the three that last. Everything else passes. These three last forever, faith, hope, and love, because God lasts forever, and our relationship with God lasts forever. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Richard. That does help. And thank you from all of us.
You're welcome. You sure look cold over there.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.